Chapter 5. Traffic Law Enforcement. Most good people, those citizens just going about their daily lives and routines, usually come into contact with a police officer only when they wave at them during a parade, see them on television, or find themselves being pulled over for something that, in their mind, they didn't do. Typically, these traffic stops are a result of a traffic violation, or perhaps an equipment violation, that they had no idea existed on their vehicle, such as a taillight, headlight, or license plate light burned out. The traffic laws in every state are miles long, seemingly never-ending. In fact, I would wager that most cops don't even know all of the violations that exist on the books, since they differ from state to state. So how would any motorist possibly be educated in all of them? Regardless, traffic law enforcement takes up a large chunk of time in a police officer's career. The goal here is to simply create a safer driving environment so that people don't die. That's the easiest way to put it, so people don't die. Still, from the citizen's point of view, cops are out to get them in regard to speeding and the like. You know what? They're right. Our job is to find those breaking the law and stop them. The end goal is to prevent poor driving habits and unsafe acts that lead to traffic crashes. Speeding and intersection violations seem to be the most common contributing factor to traffic accidents. Beyond that, guess what? There are a multitude of arrests that come from stopping cars. What do we find among the motoring public from a police officer's point of view? Illegal drugs, drug traffickers, people wanted for anything you can imagine, drunk and drugged drivers, illegal weapons and guns, those who just committed a crime who are leaving the scene, and drivers who have been forbidden to drive, suspended, revoked, denied. The list goes on and on. If you think about it, how else does the criminal element move around? Besides walking or riding a bike, they are in motor vehicles. How do illegal drugs and guns get into and across the United States to your neighborhood streets? Yes, in a motor vehicle. So as the law-abiding citizen reading this book, open up your mind and think about the big picture of what a police officer is hunting for. It's not just to write you a speeding ticket. We are digging, searching, and looking deeper into the traffic stop than you can ever imagine. Most people are not intentionally speeding. They simply lose track of time and space and have no idea how fast they're really going. This is why in Michigan, traffic violations are civil infractions and not a criminal violation. The laws also require only that the officer prove by the preponderance of evidence, 51%, that the violation occurred and not beyond a reasonable doubt, as in a criminal case. Another assumption so many speeding violators make is that the speed they were clocked at is the speed they were going when they hit the brakes after spotting the police. The reality of it is that the police see you speeding and have measured your speed well before the speeding driver ever notices the police officer. A traffic stop for a civil infraction violation, speeding, disobeying a traffic signal, defective equipment, etc., may be the first time this citizen has ever come in contact with a police officer. We must make this initial contact a professional experience. One that leaves in the mind of the citizen is the thought, wow, that officer was very polite, regardless of whether or not a citation is issued. If you, the officer, are not already starting out your initial contact, as in the example below, then give it a try. Good afternoon. May I see your driver's license, please? The reason I stopped you was, fill in the blank, do you have your vehicle registration and insurance? Remember the mirror effect I talked about earlier? Always start out polite and professional. Adjust your demeanor as needed, depending on the situation, since every traffic stop is different, just as all people are different. Here is a common mistake so many cops make. Not only is it unprofessional, but it implies that you, the officer, don't know why you're pulling someone over. Also, it leads citizens to believe that you are trying to trick them into admitting that they have done something wrong. Again, don't start out this way. Hi, do you know why I pulled you over? May I see your driver's license? When you start out this way, and I know you do because I've been pulled over myself, you're implying to the citizen that you are an idiot, pulling me over for no reason. Even if you have a perfectly good reason to stop me, A greeting like the above implies that you don't. Can you see the difference? Give it a shot. You will find that you are arguing much, much less with motorists about why they were stopped, and you will have better control of the situation. From a tactical aspect, having the person's driver's license or ID in your possession should be your first priority. Think to yourself, if I get shot, then what? Imagine this scene. You pull a vehicle over, walk up to the driver, explain why you stopped him or her, and then you're arguing with the driver as to the allegations you have made. You don't have a driver's license in your hand, and boom, you get shot in the face. The driver takes off, leaving you dead or bleeding out in the street. How can you help track down your killer? Get that driver's license in your hand as one of the first things you do when making driver contact, and stick it in your pocket. Of course, this can't always happen. Still, it was running through my mind all the time. If I get shot, then what? I want my partners to find the suspect's driver's license on me, so that the suspect can be caught and held accountable for murdering me. This was just my tactic. If you have a better one, then awesome. Traffic stop survival tactics. For police officers, stopping traffic violators is one of the most common functions we perform. And as I found out in the beginning of my career, it can certainly be one of the most dangerous situations you can ever find yourself in. Consider the tactics I've outlined below to help better prepare you so that you don't fall victim to the deadly fate so many of our brothers and sisters in our profession have been killed performing. Call out your traffic stop to dispatch before you turn on the overheads. Location, vehicle plate, description, and number of occupants if more than two. For example, unit, City Baker 11 traffic stop, dispatch, 11 go ahead. Unit, Michigan and Rose, Charles Adam 2698, dispatch, 2301, that's the time. Tactically, this communication is good, because you're telling dispatch all of the traffic stop information before you turn on the emergency lights. That way, if or when the vehicle flees, you have already called out this information and can then focus on the occupants. Remember, update dispatch if your location changes, because your next radio traffic may very well be 11 City, shots fired. Prepare yourself for this possibility on every stop. Think to yourself, if I get shot, then what? Further advice about protecting yourself when making a traffic stop includes position your patrol car so that you can effectively use it for cover and adjust this position based on traffic flow situations, especially on busy streets and highways. Reposition your car so that it absorbs a rear-end collision impact to help you survive while sitting in your car. Once the vehicle is pulled over, change the overhead lights in your patrol car to rear warning only so that you are not blinded by your own lights when you look back at your cruiser or if the driver needs to submit to field sobriety tests. At night, turn on the spotlights quickly so that you can observe furtive movements inside the suspect vehicle. A tactic I loved and learned from the Michigan State Police was to turn on my spotlight during daytime stops and point it behind me toward oncoming traffic to help with warning approaching vehicles. Crank those tires right or left, depending on how your car is positioned. These are great bullet stoppers and can help provide you with more cover from ground-level bullets. Keep in mind that bullets will hug the ground if they are fired under your car. It would suck to get your feet shot out from underneath you. Cranking your tires will also help propel your car away from the traffic stop, if hit from behind, rather than ramming into you or the vehicle you just pulled over. Don't slam your door. This is not a game of hide and go seek. So don't slam your door, which is my biggest pet peeve of all time. Simply allow the door to close quietly, or leave it still slightly open. You don't want to let suspects know when you're on your way up to their car. On the other hand, though, you might want to slam your door twice on purpose if you are on solo patrol. In Kalamazoo, we were solo both day and night, so I would slam my door twice and do a passenger side approach if I had multiple occupants in a suspect vehicle and wanted them to think that there was more than one officer pulling them over. I loved watching them trying to find the second officer who never existed. If you are on a busy road or highway, do a passenger side approach so you can look inside the suspect vehicle without getting hit by a passing vehicle. How many cops getting hit on the highways does it take for us to stop doing driver's side approaches? A passenger side approach is also a great tactic if you are on solo patrol on a stop that you feel is not good. This is when you need to listen to your sixth sense. Here are some dead giveaways that tell you to use a passenger side approach. A. The vehicle is slow to pull over. B. You see the driver or passengers reaching down under the seats or other furtive movements that may indicate they are armed. C. You see the driver or passengers moving around and really trying to find you in the mirrors. On approach, watch those hands and observe, observe, observe. Don't get locked in with looking at the eyes of the occupants. Your goal is to observe the interior of the vehicle for weapons and contraband to further your investigation and keep from getting shot. Ask yourself during every approach and while you're standing at the door this question: how can I keep from getting shot when they start shooting? Once you're in position, stay slightly behind the occupants so that they have to turn their heads to see you. Keep the B post as your friend. This post is the vertical door frame between the front and back doors. It may be your only piece of cover. Always watch the hands. At some point when you feel it is safe, you need to make a step forward to view under the driver's seat from the front to give you a better view of the center console and under the front of the seats. It takes only a quick moment to take two steps forward while viewing this area and inspecting the VIN plate and the dashboard. Driver: I don't have a driver's license, officer. Arrest the driver now. You have an arrest, so make it. You need to positively identify this person before you decide to cite and release or lodge. I'm sure you would hate to let a wanted person go, right? Let's not debate the issue with the driver. Before I make this arrest, though, I like to make the driver think that he or she might have a way out, so I hand the driver my notepad and pen and have the driver write down his or her name, birth date, address, and social security number. Most of the time, yes, you guessed it, they will lie about the name and write down only parts of the real name. However, on some rare occasions, the driver simply left his or her license at home. Either way, that person is coming out of that car in handcuffs and going into the cruiser for a citation or a ride to jail. The great thing about your notepad is that you then have a piece of evidence when you charge the driver with giving you a false name in an attempt to obstruct you and disguise his or her true identity. Remember that question: how can I keep from getting shot when they start shooting? This problem is exactly why you want to make this arrest. If you decide to take down the driver's name and return to your patrol car to try to identify the person, you have to make a return trip back to the suspect vehicle. All that time, the driver has been sitting up there thinking, how am I going to get out of this? Knowing full well you're going to be arresting the driver. This just gives that person an opportunity to plan out an escape or assault against you. Or the driver will just take off and then the chase is on. Make the arrest and you can avoid all of these problems in the first place. Don't turn around and walk back to your car. You're going to get shot in the back. You needed to learn how to check for traffic and walk backward, feeling for the corner of your car and watching the suspect vehicle. If you practice this method, you'll have it down pat after just a few times, and it will become second nature to you. The suspect is watching you walk back to your cruiser. When you don't turn your back, if the driver has dealt with the police before, he or she is going to see this difference and know that he or she will not be able to do anything against you because you are ready for it. Remember, this may be a potential predator you are dealing with, and you must not become the prey. If you have not slammed your door but left it open, you can sit down and not close your door all the way. Something strange might happen now. The driver could get out of the car. Now what? You get out of your car, too. Don't let the driver walk back to you and kill you sitting in your car. Meet the driver halfway, or tell him or her to please have a seat back in the vehicle. So what will you do if you sit back down in your patrol car and the driver starts shooting? Escape out the front passenger side door of your cruiser and use your car as cover while you return fire? throw your cruiser into reverse while staying low inside the car to avoid being shot through the windshield? Put your car in drive and run over the assailant with your car? Maneuver your cruiser away from the shooter and return fire? Shoot through the windshield? These are the scenarios you must always be running through your mind. Options? It's deadly force at this point, so your only option is to win. Once you have returned to the suspect vehicle and you're issuing the citation, keep it out of your gun hand. If you're solo, call for backup to make an arrest. Why risk it? Time is on your side, usually. Make it an unfair fight. 2-1 is much better odds than 1-on-1. To avoid a fight at the door, consider this tactic. You have an arrest to make of the driver. Instead of having him or her step out of the vehicle, simply tell the person that he or she is under arrest and have the driver spin around in the seat, put hands behind the back, handcuff them, and then have the driver step out of the car. I avoided so many assaults this way. It's an unexpected action that throws the driver off guard. Remember, the driver knows he or she is going to jail, so if you present that person with the opportunity to escape or to assault you, the driver's going to take it. Why risk it? Just say, "Okay, sir, there is a warrant for your arrest. You are under arrest at this time, so just spin around in your seat and put your hands behind your back." Backup officers, when you hear your partners call out a traffic stop, go to them, or at least start their way. When this is not possible, always have your radio ear tuned in so that when they do call out a stop, you already know where they are when they start screaming for help. It's common to arrive at another officer's stop and just drive by, give a thumbs up, and away you go into the night. Rather, pull up behind your partner, lights off so you don't backlight them, and turn on your rear overheads to add warning to approaching traffic. Get out and be a rock star backup officer. Your mere presence may be the deciding factor if your partner is going home alive that day or not. Don't be complacent. Take the time to do backup. Officers, don't be so proud that you don't call for backup. Call for backup, please. Whenever I called for another unit on one of my thousands of traffic stops, not once did any of my partners ridicule me for calling. We are a team and here for each other. You want the odds in your favor, so call for backup. I attended a risk management seminar in 2006 presented by Gordon Graham of Graham Research Consultants, and he offered one of the best quotes I've ever heard that will sum up the issues of officer safety. It's predictable, preventable. If in the course of your career, you simply keep this quote in mind, I know it will help you increase your personal level of officer safety in your daily patrols. For example, if you're responding emergency status in answer to a call and you're pushing that cruiser well over the speed limit, lose control, and crash without wearing your seatbelt, it's pretty damn predictable that you'll be killed, right? In addition to not wearing your seatbelt, another common practice for officers is to affect a traffic stop and approach the driver from the driver's side of the suspect vehicle on a busy street or highway. We can say it's predictable, based on the history of officers struck by passing vehicles, that you're more likely to be hit and killed by a passing car if you're standing in the street at the driver's door than if you make a passenger side approach and stand out of the way of traffic, right? Let's take it to another level of common complacency that officers seem to continue that ends in a fatality. If you go on patrol and don't wear a bulletproof vest and are engaged in a gunfight, odds are that if you're hit by a suspect's bullet, you're not going to survive, right? So let's prevent those tactical mistakes that we can predict. Officer discretion and how it evolved over time. My personal level of officer discretion changed and evolved over my 25 years of stopping traffic violators. When I first started out in this career, I felt that a warning was in order for most violators and that it would help with police-citizen relations. In particular, I thought that giving a warning to an upset motorist would somehow smooth things over and that he or she would leave the traffic stop with a more positive outlook upon the police. Boy, was I surprised to find out how fast this behavior would backfire on me. I gave my first verbal warning to a drunk driver in Lawrence. before you all start to panic. No, I didn't just let her drive away. I actually gave this person a ride home and wrote her a ticket for failing to signal. I parked and locked her car on the roadside. Do you see anything wrong with this picture? The year was 1988, and I had been a cop for only 1 month. I was naive and didn't realize the possible ramifications for making this dumb decision. About 4 hours later, I was dispatched to a crash only a mile down the road from where the original traffic stop took place. You guessed it. That same person I gave a break to came back to get her car and promptly crashed it into a tree as she failed to navigate a curve. You could say that I got a good talking to the next day by the chief after I explained the situation to him. Lesson learned. Arrest the drunk driver every time. Thank God nobody else was hurt or killed, and thankfully, the driver herself wasn't injured. This situation would have all been avoided had I simply done the right thing first and made the arrest. Amazingly, I didn't learn my lesson after this incident. Almost an identical traffic stop took place on the exact same stretch of roadway, and this time I wrote the driver a ticket for careless driving. I had the front seat passenger drive the car instead of the intoxicated female. Back in 1988, the legal limit in Michigan was a 0.10% blood alcohol content, and we relied heavily on the results of the preliminary breath test. The PBT indicated a 0.10%, so I decided to give another break. Instead of arresting the woman for drunk driving, I chose to cite her for careless driving. What was I thinking? Why on earth did I make this stupid decision? The feeling among other cops back in 1988 was that if you had drunks who blew just a 0.10%, then they really weren't that drunk. It's similar to catching a 12-inch bass, you know, barely a keeper. I felt that if I arrested this person who didn't seem that drunk, I could be facing peer pressure from other officers or would be perceived to have an overly aggressive attitude towards citizens and lawbreakers. I know. Crazy, right? I should never have let my personal thoughts and opinions influence my decisions when it came to enforcing the law. I got lucky. No crash this time, and I thought I actually did the right thing. No arrest, the person was off the street, and I still cited the driver for driving poorly. Everything was fine until I received a subpoena to appear at an informal hearing where this same violator was contesting the ticket for careless driving. At the informal hearing, the magistrate heard the case, and I testified to the facts of the violation, including my decision to give her a break for drunk driving. During the informal hearing, I mentioned that the PBT indicated 0.10% breath alcohol content. The violator insisted that she wasn't drunk, that I was lying, and that she was driving just fine. The magistrate found her not responsible, and she left with a smirk on her face, with words I'll never forget. You small-town cops ain't shit. The magistrate told me to stay in his office. He took off his reading glasses, held around his neck by a chain, and said, "Well, I hope you don't ever do that again." He had some great words of wisdom for me. "Todd, if you ever have someone who's at or near the legal limit for drunk driving, just arrest them." At that moment, I made a career decision to never, never, ever give another break to a drunk driver. It set me on the right path, and I never gave another break to a drunk driver again. I learned that people don't appreciate a break even if you think you are giving them one, and my job is not to drive around and give warnings, but to enforce the laws I swore to uphold. The decision to issue a traffic ticket or a verbal warning. So, how did I decide to write a traffic ticket or just give a verbal warning? This is a simple answer for me, but every officer has a different opinion on this. I would always issue a traffic ticket unless A, you were on your way to the hospital and it is a true emergency, B, I stopped the wrong car. Yeah, this happens. I would always err in favor of the citizen and not risk citing the wrong person. C, I honestly thought that you, the violator, had a really good reason or excuse for breaking traffic laws. Nearly 99% of the time, anyone I stopped was cited. I felt that I wasn't getting paid to drive around and stop people to give them a warning. My job was, in my mind, to enforce the laws. 1. You are a fellow police officer or a family member of a police officer. Pulling over a fellow officer is very rare, by the way, and to those citizens who think professional courtesy means cops are driving around ignoring the traffic laws, speeding, etc., you could not be more incorrect. Police officers are probably the safest drivers out on the road, as we essentially drive for a living and see the results of poor driving habits. Keep in mind, too, that as an officer, in Kalamazoo anyway, if you crashed a cruiser and were at fault, you would be issued a traffic ticket in addition to disciplinary action. Now you know, we are not above the law. 2. The exception to all of the above resulting in a citation no matter who you were. If you were completely disrespectful toward me and belligerent, you would be cited. This behavior would always result in a traffic ticket or an arrest if I had probable cause to arrest you for any reason. I felt that if you had what I called a poor driving attitude, then you probably didn't give a shit about anyone else on the roads and you were therefore a hazard to the motoring public. Driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs. A drunk driver is a mobile homicide waiting to happen. Robert T. Christensen. On February 18, 1995, I responded to a man down, bleeding, and severely injured. I arrived to find 33-year-old Kirk Hudson lying in a pool of blood and barely breathing with a severe head injury. Next to him lay his twisted and mangled bicycle, vehicle parts scattered all over the street near his body. Kirk Hudson died on that day, but the investigation as to who killed him was just beginning. As a result of a detailed forensic investigation and unrelenting investigative police work, the driver of the van that struck and killed Kirk Hudson was found. Evidence located at the scene of the crash would lead investigators to the owner of the van, who fled after he struck Mr. Hudson. The key to solving this crime was a small piece of plastic turn signal covering that matched exactly to the suspect vehicle. In addition to the exact match of the broken plastic piece were paint chips and other vehicle parts found at the scene and collected as evidence. The driver of the van was subsequently arrested, prosecuted, found guilty of fleeing the scene of a fatal hit-and-run crash, and served prison time for the crime. Although his level of intoxication at the time of the incident could never be proven, it was certainly suspected to be over the legal limit. This particular investigation was found to be so unique that it was described in a television episode called The Plastic Puzzle on the TV documentary series Forensic Files in 2005. It was said that in Kalamazoo, a homicide investigation was easier to complete than a drunk driving arrest. This was, of course, not true, but there were some sharp comparisons. The average length of time for a DUI investigation from time of stop to report completion was an average of 2 to 3 hours, depending on the presence of any other contributing factors that may extend that time. The shortest amount of time to complete a thorough and well-documented investigation was no less than 2 hours. What was it that would make the DUI case a living hell for an officer? Just add any of the following, and the time could be extended to up to 3 more hours. Breath test refusal, search warrant, traffic crash, blood draw procedures, secondary charges, e.g. drug possession, trafficking, resisting arrest, assaulting police officers, fleeing, eluding, warrants, and generally uncooperative subjects in particular, like those who would refuse to be fingerprinted. Overall, dealing with the intoxicated, potentially uncooperative subject is challenging for anybody, including the police. In the course of my 25 years of arresting drunk drivers, I found that I was among the top officers in Kalamazoo who consistently made the most drunk driving arrests on an annual basis. I pride myself on the fact that the majority of these cases resulted in a conviction of some type. What I learned most about this experience was the importance of attention to detail throughout the investigation, report writing, and courtroom testimony. Toward the later years of my career, I learned from local city attorneys that they actually enjoyed prosecuting my cases and were less likely to plead them down to a lesser offense because I had developed a reputation of documenting a thorough investigation and being exact in my courtroom testimony. I wasn't the type of officer who craved a conviction. If I thought the investigation was incomplete in any way, or if I had made a mistake, which was typically the failure to document properly, I would not hesitate to err on the side of justice and lobby for a dropped charge, or simply testify to the facts of the case, even if that meant a not guilty verdict. Courtroom integrity was my priority. There were even some cases in which I would admit that an investigation was flawed, or that I could empathize with a defendant on why a driving mistake may have been made due to confusing traffic laws. I would never try to hide or cover up anything. The worst thing an officer could do was to jeopardize his or her personal integrity in the courtroom. This has third and fourth order effects that will destroy your career both on and off duty. Just be honest. If you screw up, learn from it, and don't make the mistake again. I established a solid reputation in court for being an honest officer and one who would tell it like it was. It was a great feeling while on the witness stand, when a judge would make remarks in reference to my personal integrity. It was devastating to the defense counsel. I recall my first drunk driving arrest in Kalamazoo, although this was typically what we would term a routine event for any officer. Kalamazoo seemed to add an additional system of checks and balances to how we conducted a drunk driving investigation. My first arrest took nearly 6 hours to complete the Kalamazoo Public Safety Way. Since I had worked previously as a police officer in Lawrence, I felt relatively confident in my ability to process a drunk driver in the right way. However, in Kalamazoo, Sergeant John Irby taught me the finer art of investigations and how a thorough drunk or drug driving investigation should be completed. It was Sergeant Irby's passion for excellence and his dedication to duty and his troops that established a foundation for me throughout my Kalamazoo career. It was this extra effort taken by a supervisor that helped me grow into an effective public safety officer and instilled a sense of personal motivation to complete every investigation in the most thorough and accurate manner. Attention to detail is key. Two such cases come to mind. First, back in 1991, I arrested a gentleman for drunk driving, and during the courtroom testimony, the defense attorney asked me to tell the court what the results of the breathalyzer test were. I replied simply, 12%. A motion was immediately filed to suppress my testimony because I didn't state that the results showed 12% blood alcohol content by weight. Well, we lost the case. Afterward, I asked the defense attorney what I could have done differently to avoid making such a mistake in the future. He replied, "You have to pay attention to detail and follow the administrative rules. I bet you won't do that again, though, will you?" I never forgot this lesson, and made it a career goal to never lose another case because of my own mistakes, or what is termed a technicality. The second case was in my final year in Kalamazoo. The case was dismissed by the judge from a motion by the defense attorney, alleging that the reason for the stop was invalid because the defendant didn't break any traffic laws. The incident revolved around the placement of a no-left-turn sign. The defendant had turned left from a store parking lot adjacent to the intersection. Two no-left-turn signs were clearly posted at the intersection and across the street. I stopped the motorist for the violation. The issue raised by the defense attorney was that the no-left-turn sign wasn't erected properly according to the traffic code prohibiting vehicles from making a left turn from the parking lot, thus making the reason for the stop invalid. I testified that this was true. There wasn't a sign in the parking lot indicating no left turn as required by the law. I also testified that based on the law, the stop was invalid. Now, on the night in question, I had no idea what the municipal code was for the placement of traffic signs, and I doubt most officers did unless they were previously an employee of the Public Works Department and knew what regulations governed sign placement. I had no problem losing this case. The fact of the matter was that it was an invalid stop. Did a drunk driver get away? No. He was arrested on the night in question, and potentially lives were saved, including his own. In addition, the city traffic engineer learned his lesson in court and would pay closer attention to proper sign placement to avoid losing these cases in the future and to properly direct the motoring public. In Kalamazoo, the call volume was heaviest between 4 in the afternoon and 3 in the morning. During this time, if the calls for service were excessive, the last thing an officer would want to do was bone his zone partner by arresting a drunk driver. This would mean the other officers would have to take most of the calls for service, and or other PSOs would infiltrate a zone and have to take your calls while you were tied up in the jail with a drunk. We prided ourselves on taking care of our own zones. It was part of our community policing efforts, in my mind anyway, to take care of my own neighborhood. Hell, I knew it better than any other officer coming to take a call from another part of the city. The downside to this situation was that there were times when drunk drivers would either not be stopped or may simply have been let go by officers who didn't want to deal with a 2-hour-plus process of a drunk driving investigation. Was this the right thing to do? You can argue both ways, but the answer is no. Letting criminals go is not the right thing to do ever, especially a potential mobile homicide suspect. However, there were times when an officer needed to quit stopping cars and concentrate on taking the calls for service in his or her zone. It was difficult, especially in the warm spring and summer, to keep up with just the calls for service. After 2 in the morning, though, drunks were fair game, and it was expected that they would be arrested and taken off the streets. When I started in 1991, I remember having over 20 PSOs working the street during the shift. Over the years, through contract negotiations, budget cuts, retirements, and a hiring freeze, this number continued to decline. When I retired in 2012, the minimum staffing level for PSOs was just 13 officers working the street. You can easily see how staffing levels affect the quality of service delivery for any department. If you don't have the officers to keep up with the call volume, something has to suffer. There were some nights when it was so busy that the shift lieutenant would simply clear the board, so to speak, and we would just start over with a new shift and new calls for service because we could not keep up with the calls that were still remaining. The calls that would simply disappear were nonviolent, quality of life calls such as parking complaints, noise, fireworks, barking dogs, loud music, junked or abandoned autos, and traffic complaints. In other words, we ignored the type of call that, for the most part, was a nuisance call that would result in an officer checking the area several hours later to find nothing going on. We hated to do this, but like a hospital emergency room, we prioritized or triaged the most violent or criminal calls where there was a victim or that required immediate police response. As the years progressed, the department became much more efficient in responding to each and every call for service in a timely manner and streamlined the reporting system to meet the needs of the public. Of course, we continued to search for ways to cut costs and provide quality police, fire, EMS services. There was a handful of officers who took this mindset of being proactive in arresting drunk and drug drivers to heart and effectively saved lives by making many drunk driving arrests. The officers who truly made a difference and saved lives on the streets were Chuck Dollinger, Tim Randall, Marty Buffenbarger, John Irby, Fidel Morales, and me. Interestingly, prior to being hired by Kalamazoo Public Safety, each of us had worked at other departments. It was commonplace for each of us to make at least 1 to 3 drunk driving arrests in just one shift. As a result of my proactive patrols and high number of alcohol-related arrests, I was awarded the Mothers Against Drunk Driving Award in 1990 and Police Officer of the Year in 2007 from the Western Michigan University Students Against Drunk Driving Organization. Nominations for the Police Officer of the Year Award were based on enforcement and prevention initiatives dealing with drunk driving, minors in possession of alcohol, illegal liquor establishment violations, liquor violations committed by local liquor stores and bars, and drugged driving arrests. I pride myself on taking action where many other officers would not. I think that the reason was that many officers just didn't feel capable conducting the investigation in a timely and thorough manner. To help our troops in this area, I developed a report writing guide, along with the city attorney, to help educate our officers on how to conduct these investigations and how to document a thorough and detailed police report. I did this through the use of effective headings to give officers a street guide for attention to detail. The following is a basic template to use when completing a drunk driving and drugged driving police report. Of course, you may need to add headings depending upon your local jurisdiction's standard operating procedures and local prosecuting attorney's guidance. Summary: no more than 3 to 5 sentences. Traffic law violations. Your reasonable suspicions and your reason for the stop. Contact with driver. Your initial observations and statements. Tell why he or she was stopped. Driver statements before arrest. What the driver said. At the time of the stop, ask everything you need to know so that if the driver refuses to answer questions after Miranda, you already have these statements. Dexterity test. Results of the standardized field sobriety tests, preferred. Signs and symptoms of alcohol intoxication, what you saw, heard, and smelled. Signs and symptoms of drug influence, what you saw, heard, and smelled. Become familiar with all drug effects on the human body. Preliminary breath test. Results of test. Should be given if you suspect drugs. Results will show a low or no BAC level. Arrest. Any out-of-the-ordinary circumstances. Resistance. Voluntary statements. Vehicle search. Reason for search. Evidence. List of all evidence seized. Follow your department SOPs. Vehicle disposition. Towed or parked. Chemical test rights. What the driver said when asked to take the breath test. Breath test. Any out-of-the-ordinary circumstances and the results. Search warrant. Name of the judge. Provide the suspect with a copy of the affidavit. Blood draw. Search warrant or consent. Follow department SOPs. Miranda rights. State of driver's mind or ability to understand rights. At arrest, read them off the Miranda card, not from memory. And time read. Follow department SOP. Driver statements after arrest. What the driver said. Voluntary. Miranda interview. Miranda waived. Witness statement. Names of all passengers in the vehicle and their statements about the driver's level of intoxication or drug use. Citations issued. Citation numbers, if issued, follow department SOPs. Digital video recorder, DVR/MVR number. Before you sit down with your cup of coffee to begin your report, it's paramount that you take the time to review the entire stop from start to finish from your in-car mobile video. You want to ensure you are documenting exactly what you saw from your video and listen to the statements made by the suspects and the questions you asked on video. Take notes. Don't document your report based on memory. Take the time to document accurately. Pay close attention to details so that you don't contradict yourself in the report. Remember that the video is what the jury and attorneys will see when matching up your police report to the documentation seen on the television. Pay attention to detail. You can lose a case simply because you failed to document accurately what really took place. Racial profiling versus criminal profiling. A traffic stop is based on the driver committing a violation of the law, right? Or is it based on race? Racial profiling is a hot-button topic for every agency. Does profiling exist? Of course. But how is profiling an offender different from racially motivated profiling? I think this is the real question. The argument goes back and forth, and there is no clear-cut answer, survey, study, or theory that can pinpoint it. Perhaps it is up to our fellow police officers to police themselves and have the personal courage to stand up for what is right. Racial profiling does exist, and I have witnessed it. In the middle 1990s, I changed zones and worked the downtown area, referred to as Zone 1. The great thing about being a Zone 1 PSO in Kalamazoo was that you responded to all fires in the city and were not restricted to patrol only one particular neighborhood. You had the flexibility to roam the entire city. With that, you got boned on a lot of calls in other zones. But hey, if you want to be a busy officer, then work Zone 1. Zone 1 was my favorite zone to work. I had a great spot in there in which to do drug interdiction also. The area was what I called the honey hole. It was at the intersection of the main route to get from the south, east, and north neighborhoods. There was a posted 25-mile-per-hour zone rife with violators. During drug interdiction, the key to success is a numbers game. Stop as many cars as possible and try to gain consent or probable cause to search a vehicle. The result is many, many, many drug charges. Working on this plan, I would park perpendicular to the street and keep my headlights on and shining across the street. This position would allow me to see seatbelt violators and items dangling from rearview mirrors. The use of a handheld radar and laser made it perfect to monitor speeding cars coming at me also. Remember, we're talking a numbers game, so that means all traffic violations are going to be stopped regardless of race or gender. I began to notice a trend about one of my partners, and it took me a good year to catch on to his technique. Perhaps he didn't realize he was doing it, but I did, and it made me suspicious that he was intentionally stopping vehicles with race as a contributing factor in the stop. I saw him let many white offenders, particularly elderly whites, go on their way without being stopped. Not once did a minority get that same treatment. Is that racial profiling? You tell me. One call we handled together pretty much ended our professional relationship. I responded to a domestic assault call where the relationship was a same-sex boyfriend-boyfriend assault. It was no different from the typical male-female attacks, just one of the same sex and just as violent. The victim in this case, nicknamed Peaches, had called police for help after he had been assaulted by his live-in boyfriend. The suspect in the case had fled the scene, and I had probable cause to arrest him for domestic violence. Within minutes after the suspect had fled, my partner contacted me on the radio and advised me to switch to a tactical channel. While on the other channel, he told me, "Yeah, pretty sure this is your guy. He has the identifiable rainbow tattoo." I told my partner to just arrest him and handle that part of the case for me while I took care of the victim information. The suspect was subsequently arrested. Later on that night, we were compiling our reports when I asked my partner if he had the report from that arrest. He replied, "Here's your faggot report." I was taken aback for a moment and was processing in my mind what to say. Then it just came out. I snapped back, "Thanks. And do you have the nigger reports from earlier, too? I mean, if we're going to bash people, we might as well bash everyone." The sergeant's office door burst open, and it was clear that he was pissed. Obviously, he had overheard our conversation, perhaps because I might have been talking loud and in a condescending tone when I snapped back at my partner. I had heard this officer making off-the-wall comments before about gays and minorities, and I was simply fed up with it. The sergeant ordered, "Todd, go back to the road. You, in my office." Nothing else was said to me about this situation. I felt distant from my partner after this incident, and shortly thereafter I switched stations to Zone 6. I felt uncomfortable working with him and felt he could not be trusted. This situation just makes me sick to my stomach. In an interesting twist of events, since my retirement from Kalamazoo, I had the opportunity to talk to the victim in this case, and Peaches was so proud to tell me that he feels my intervention was fate and that it was the only way he could get out of a violent relationship. He refers to me as his superhero. When I heard that, I said, "You're welcome, Peaches, but I was just doing my job. I'm honored to call you my friend today." How can we, as a criminal justice profession, address the injustices of racially motivated policing while effectively preventing crime through criminal profiling tactics? The issue is not only racial profiling, but profiling people simply because they are different. So now this includes everyone, right? And yes, this means white people too. As a society, we generally consider race being the only factor when speaking of profiling, when in reality, what society is not considering are the totality of circumstances that surround the mindset of what a police officer is thinking when a potential offender is detained. I want you to examine this scenario and then ask yourself, was this a racially motivated police-citizen contact? You are a police officer working in a predominantly black neighborhood in an inner city neighborhood. Your sector of patrol is known for street-level drug deals, and it's commonplace for you to respond to drive-by shootings by which drug dealers are battling each other for turf. The neighborhood is rampant with abandoned homes and run-down buildings. Rival gang graffiti is painted all over the street signs, fences, and on the sides of empty buildings. You frequently respond to assaults whereby people walking down the street or sidewalk are attacked and oftentimes robbed. You typically respond to drug overdose medical calls throughout the shift, and nearly everyone you come in contact with for either a traffic violation or while on a call are wanted for outstanding warrants. Throughout your tour of duty, you are dispatched to citizen complaints of street-level drug dealing, loud car stereos, people yelling, and loitering on private property at all hours of the night. Keep in mind that this is a predominantly black neighborhood, and while on patrol, you spot a vehicle that has circled the same block three times. As it approaches a group of black males walking alongside the street, it slows down as if the occupants want to say something to them. And then it continues to drive on, but only to drive around the block again. This time it fails to signal a turn. As the car passes, you see the driver is a white male and not wearing a seatbelt. You turn around and immediately stop the car for the observed violations. What questions come to mind? Remember, you're the police officer. Why is a white guy in this neighborhood? What's your underlying suspicion? What might you suspect this white guy is doing? He's probably not looking to buy a house, right? No, he's looking to buy drugs. So was this a racially motivated stop? Of course not. First of all, there must be a valid reason to stop a car, i.e., a traffic violation must occur. Simply seeing a white guy driving around may raise your suspicion, but you must develop reasonable suspicion to initiate police contact and/or have a valid reason to detain him, such as any law or ordinance violation. Now, add one more factor to the above scenario, and you can see how we have blurred the racial issue. The police officer is black, and the offender is white, or vice versa. And in many cases, take this factor out and make the race the same for both. The white offender will assume and proclaim to the officer, "The only reason you stopped me was because I'm a white guy driving in a black neighborhood." Let's add one more variable to the above situation. It is the night shift, and you, as the officer, have no idea what the race of the offender may be. But the actions of the vehicle's driver raise your suspicions that criminal activity is afoot. With that, you now have a traffic violation that legally permits you to stop the vehicle. Remember, you have no idea what the race of the driver is. This is a common issue for every night shift officer that society does not realize or comprehend. Many times the officer pulling you over, particularly at night, has no idea what your race is, and it does not matter. You're being stopped for the law violation. So we should not be so quick to blame the officer for stopping people based solely on race. Another fallacy our society has is this: only black people are stopped in this neighborhood, or only whites are stopped in this neighborhood. This is especially true in neighborhoods where the majority of the population is made up by one particular race of people. Of course, more whites or blacks are going to be stopped if the makeup of the neighborhood is dominated by the particular race. This makes sense, right? It does not mean the officers are racist by any stretch of the imagination. I hope you can see the difference between criminal profiling and racial profiling. How can issues in profiling people based on anything other than criminal activity be eliminated? I believe it is a matter of education throughout the ranks of all agencies and at every level of an officer's career to help open up a dialogue and method of understanding and mutual respect toward each other as human beings relative not only to race, but also ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender, religious beliefs, and national origin. At the end of the day, the issues of police officers focusing attention toward certain individuals or groups must be criminal intent driven and not based on the individual themselves. In addition to education, continued diversification of the police force overall, and an active recruiting initiative to seek out qualified minority police officers so that the department maintains a force of highly qualified and educated officers.